Welcome to episode 274 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
I'm Phil Barton.
This is one in a short series on computers, computing, and the history thereof. If you'd like to hear the other episodes, you can find them by visiting thelabwithbrad.com.
I just don't feel it today.
You're not all that agreeable.
I don't know what
I think 270 is the episode we started this. I should have looked this up and been able to say, hey, started episode two, whatever.
We got another
70,
one.
70, I think.
Yeah. We should have been saying that from day one.
Right? Yeah, I did actually, day one, at least on Twitter.
Oh.
If you ever want to join us there, at Lobby and Lab is the user handle for me and the show.
Mm-hmm.
Phil is also on Twitter, but you can't tell.
I got a new phone. I don't know how to get into that account anymore.
All right, so the wheels are turning.
Okay.
And have been turning for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And the water wheel had spread all over the place.
Okay.
And people had discovered this reversible system
mm-hmm.
where either the water moves and turns the wheel.
Okay.
Or you can turn the wheel and move the water.
Oh, hey. good for irrigation, right?
And it was fantastic. Oh, yes, actually, many a water pump was designed to move water from A to B thanks to the wheel. Sometimes the wheel would be turned by the water and pump it the other direction at the same time. But people were getting used to the idea that these wheels would do work for you.
Yeah,
instead of you or your animals, and actually we're better at it than all the king's horses and all the king's men.
A little effort here and we don't have to, gravity will work again.
Right. So some innovations took place in the field of weaving.
Weaving.
Things like the flying shuttle, whatever that is.
Oh, I've heard of it. Yeah, yep.
I don't want to get into it because I don't get it.
Yeah.
But this was the start of the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, hey.
It was actually starting with mills and mill ponds and rivers and streams and so forth,
mm-hmm.
water-powered, and all these automatic machines to do this tedious thing we used to call weaving.
Yeah, nice.
Taking it out of the cottage industry, where it was literally an industry done in cottages.
Oh, well, hence the name. Okay.
Yes. And starting to industrialize. In the middle of the 1600s, 1649, maybe 1650, depending upon who you ask.
Nice, though. Middle.
Yeah, really. Audubon Gericke?
Sure.
This guy, this German guy,
mm-hmm.
he invented the air pump.
We're on water right now, Gericke. What's wrong with you? What, man?
But it turns out if you take an air pump and put it on a sealed container,
mm-hmm.
you can get a partial vacuum.
Okay.
Now, the big technical challenge here was to get a cylinder and a piston that wouldn't leak. Had varying degrees of success with this.
Mm-hmm.
But he was able to demonstrate things like that. Hey, light goes through a vacuum, sound does not. Little birdies can't breathe, fire won't burn, you know, things like that.
Little birdies can't breathe.
Yes, I'm sorry. Those were actual experiments done.
No.
Really popular, by the way.
Suffocating birdies.
That's the suffocating birdies. Well, actually, yeah. There was this whole sort of side industry of people who would take scientific breakthroughs
mm-hmm.
and turn them into street shows.
Oh, hey, okay.
Whether or not they had a lecture hall to perform in, you know, they'd be doing basically what amount to magic tricks.
Yeah.
They had like the magic lantern, and vacuum was a big hit. They, you know, used to take a couple of hemispheres
mm-hmm.
with a little gap inside.
Oh, okay.
Pump the air out of it and then have horses try to break apart the little ball, and they couldn't.
Nice. Horses. Wow. This happened in seventh grade science class. There was a vacuum pump, and there was two plates. You hook up the vacuum to that, and then you hand it to the strongest guy in the class.
And laugh.
Yeah.
On into the night. And then the demonstrator walks up and like flips open the little stopcock,
mm-hmm.
and with a twist of the wrist, the hemispheres fall back apart.
Yeah.
It was a very popular demonstration. And it may have influenced a fellow who decided that he should get this vacuum to do something useful, like maybe move water.
Hey, water's the thing. He was hip.
Oh, by the way, the air pump, super popular, I mentioned, right? The Roberts. Ooh. Robert Boyle and Robert Hooke.
Okay.
Got together in 1660 to make their own vacuum pump and vacuum chamber for the newly formed Royal Society of London.
For magic shows? Or what do they need vacuum for?
Research.
Of course.
They repeated many of the experiments, including, unfortunately, the one with the birds.
This is a terrible episode.
Anyway, so a guy got the idea that he could make a vacuum by condensing steam.
Interesting.
You fill a cylinder with steam, spray cold water in there, and then the steam would condense suddenly.
Oh.
Leaving behind a partial vacuum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that could be used to move a piston. And that could be used to pump some water.
Screw your water wheels.
And this was the first sort of steam engine that was made. At first, there was just one cylinder being sprayed with water. And then there was a fellow named James Watt.
Oh.
Who came along later. He was born in Scotland. And his big ambition was to become an instrument maker.
Okay.
A maker of scientific instruments and later musical instruments because there was more money there.
Well, you just answered the question. The answer was both.
Yes. But they brought him in and they showed him this steam engine. And they asked the question, what's wrong with this thing? Why does it take so much steam to move any water?
Oh, okay.
And he came up with a separate condenser. So you're no longer spraying cold water on the hot metal of the cylinder and then having to reheat the cylinder. Not to mention, you know, the fact that sometimes the metal would crack. Extreme temperatures. I'm sure you're aware of the phenomenon.
Yeah.
So James Watt, he's like, okay, listen, what we got? The condenser over here. That will fix this problem. It will work much better.
It won't break so often. You guys are nuts.
He eventually ran into someone named Matthew Boulton, who became his business partner. And they complimented each other rather well. There's James Watt, the unworldly sort, and Tinker away. And you got the other guy, Boulton, who was very business savvy.
Oh, nice.
He eventually said to James Watt, you know, it's good. Pumping water. That is a great ambition.
Yeah, yeah.
But screw the mines. Let's sell the mills. Because once you, he actually sent a letter that all the English and the French and everybody is steam mill mad.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean to rush you, but maybe you could make some device that spins.
There is an opportunity here. Have you not been paying attention to the world?
So James Watts basically came up with a transmission. He couldn't use just a crankshaft. Somebody beat him to the patent. He actually... We call them planetary gears now. At the time, he called it a sun and planets.
Oh, the automatic transmission thing?
And it gave him an ability to take these slow, ponderous, but powerful movements of the piston and turn them into fast spinning wheels.
Okay.
Which is just what all those millers ordered.
Perfect.
So now you don't even need a river or a stream to have spinning wheels, and the wheels kept on turning.
Yeah. Hey.
All right. You'll notice that this is a very gadget-heavy episode. We did talk a little bit about computer concepts on Monday. So you remember when we were talking about Leibniz?
Yeah.
And binary?
I said that, but I... No.
No.
Good old Leibniz.
Leibniz and his marbles.
If you're ever looking for enough marbles.
Lost his marbles. Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz.
Ooh, nice.
More or less invented the modern version of binary with zero and one and all that calculation. I'm not sure how much he did zero and one involved with logic.
Okay.
Reports differ. But he was very much into logic. He kind of went down a rabbit hole, actually. Became obsessed with the notion of symbolic logic, thinking that maybe he could write or create a language that was as inevitable with logic as mathematics is with numbers.
I don't get it.
So just like 2 plus 2 equals 4.
Right.
Very little room for argument.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
A plus B equals C.
Okay.
But in logical terms.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote about it later in his life. I remember that I thought that I could make this language, and then statesmen and theologians and government officials could sit around the table, take the thorny problem,
yeah, yeah,
and figure it out,
you know, turn it into this equation, and yeah,
yeah,
equal good or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, well, you know, there are limits. His binary, okay. 0 and 1. This really wasn't the first binary. We already talked about the Indian scholar from 300 BC.
Well, I thought we were going to cut the Monday.
But we've got our... It is Monday. Yes, we are. We're here now. Good job.
Indo scholar. Okay, anyways, yeah.
But Francis Bacon.
Hey!
About a century before Leibniz did his thing, came up with a binary code. He wasn't using zeros and ones, but he was specifically saying, that you could use this to encode secret messages.
Oh.
What he called differences in the font scarcely noticeable for those who are not in the know.
Okay.
And went on to say anything that can be in two different states, a flag raised or lowered, a lamp on or off.
Oh, hey, yeah.
Musket shots with bangs and pauses.
Was there a war on? What's going on? Why is he so concerned about crypto?
Well, I'm not sure. You know what? That's funny. the rest of the historical context. I've walked past that era now. I don't remember.
Okay. Yeah, screw all that crap.
There is always a war on. Early 1600s. Okay. But I this guy gets an honorary mention because I'm not sure how ancestral his notions were to what we eventually got. But I bring it up for a couple of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
First off, the history of computers is absolutely wrapped up with encryption secret messages and wars.
Oh, wars?
Yes.
Ooh.
The other thing is that it demonstrates the third thing that computers do. There's calculation.
Right.
There's logic.
Yes.
And encoding and decoding.
Okay.
Right now, at this very moment, we are chattering away.
Yep.
Our microphones turn that into electrical signals that travel down the wires into this nifty Behringer mixer.
Behringer?
Yeah. Which then turns it into a digital signal, and it is encoded into a way that the computer can play with it.
Oh.
Turns into a dance of electrical voltages across crystalline wire. That's what happens. And later, when I'm editing it and or you're listening to the podcast.
Okay.
The podcast. That same information is decoded and turned back into similar signals along your speaker's wires.
Yeah, yeah.
To make the speakers make my melodious voice.
We did plug in tones into the oscilloscope, and there was a digital version of a tone, although I don't know how that happens.
Well, let's not get too much into the encoding. I actually do. But let's not get too much into the...
Okay.
The funny thing about it is this ushers in a whole new science and discipline of computer modeling.
Okay.
And as it happens, whether Leibniz expected this or not, it's not quite as all-encompassing as he thought.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a language that is as rigorous as mathematics that will not even turn into something a computer can use unless you've written it more or less correctly.
Yeah. it's just a dang semicolon.
Yeah, you see it already.
Yeah.
The computer is the hardware, and the magic language Leibniz always dreamed of, we call programming.
Well, I can't tell good and bad. But
Not completely. There's layers.
Yeah.
And there's always the problem, especially when someone, we don't talk much about politics, but I'm going to say this.
Okay.
If someone comes out and says, we did some computer modeling, and it just happens to support their favorite political or economic theory, be suspicious.
The whole thing about my map class was all about ethics.
Mm.
Take this map and move the data around a little bit, and look at how all of the red turns to blue. Yeah.
So, another thing Otto von Guericke came up with, about the same time as his vacuum pump, was one of the first electric generators.
Really?
Now, this is an electrostatic generator.
Mm-hmm.
Not to be confused with direct current or alternating current.
Okay.
What he did is he basically got a crank and a little ball of sulfur. You turn the crank so the ball of sulfur is spinning, and then put your hand against the ball of sulfur.
And your hair would stand up.
All sorts of things would happen. Various static phenomenon, including sometimes the little sulfur bowl would glow a bit, depending upon if you got a high enough charge or not.
Huh.
Nifty stuff.
I think I saw that on Mr. Wizard once upon a time.
Actually, there were a bunch of different static generators, but he seemed to have started the craze.
Mm-hmm.
In 1705...
Okay.
Shortly after Isaac Newton had taken over the Royal Society of London.
Ooh, well, how's he right?
Isaac Newton.
His lab assistant did a demonstration, okay. 1705. And Newton kind of wanted to get back to doing weekly demonstrations.
Okay.
Which the society had moved away from, for the public and for visiting, what do you call them? Smarty pantses.
Yeah.
Hawksby was prepared for this lecture. He had his double-barreled vacuum pump. I have no idea what that means, but it was double-barreled, whatever it was. It
sounds violent.
And he had a modified version of the static generator.
Okay.
His was a hollow glass ball, and he had placed a small bit of mercury inside of it.
Okay.
Then he turned the crank, and his double-barreled vacuum pump
look out
would take the air out from within the glass ball.
Okay.
And the ball was rotating. So he'd set his hand against the glass, the charge would build up, and then it glowed.
Light. Wait a minute. What year is this? Wait. Okay.
This was in 1705.
Okay.
And yes, it was described as bright enough to read by.
Huh. Well, son of a buck.
Yes, and then this is something the street performers picked up, of course. Glowing lights.
It's amazing. We could do shows without people, you know, running into each other.
And this is an electrostatic discharge. Rarefied air will glow with plasma and physics and stuff.
Yeah. We have mercury vapor in our fluorescent lights for reasons. Yeah.
So the problem with this electricity stuff is that although they found a way to generate it, it would snap, pop, gone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and there was no way to hold it anywhere. If you waited for more than a few seconds before you made the little pop and the audience went, ooh, ah, there was no pop. No, ooh, ah, no check for you.
What are we even standing here for?
Yeah. So then this Professor Muschenberg in Leiden, Germany.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the accent's coming out.
Okay. He tried to figure out how he could save some, and he kind of tried to just pour it into the water. He had a little conductor stuck inside of a jar of water,
okay.
Attached it to one of these static generators,
and
had very little luck. He placed it on an insulating platform. He barely ever even got a spark to speak of.
Yeah.
But then one day, he charged it while he was holding it.
Okay.
And then reached up casually to touch the top.
Okay.
And received a shock severe enough to make him fear for his life.
Ooh, okay.
In a letter, he called it a new but terrible experiment, which I advise you never to try.
Oh, so everybody tried it, right?
Well, yeah, but without using their hands.
Little birdies.
What was actually going on is he figured out a sort of smack together capacitor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because the charge in the water and the conductor would be one pole, positive or negative, and the hand connected to you in the ground would be the other.
Okay.
So it was weird for them, though, the way they were thinking about it. It seemed as though the jar would hold more electric fluid if it was leaking. It wasn't until Benjamin Franklin came along that there was a theoretical explanation for what was going on there. All right, after a weird argument with the Galvani, in 1800, Volta made his pile.
I have a suspicion about that name, okay? Good old piles.
Yes, we do, in fact, name the Volt after Volta.
For making batteries.
Yes, the Voltaic pile, as it was known, was the forerunner to the modern-day battery. But there was another twist to the story. Instead of a quick little pop, and it's over, the current flowed continuously out of this battery thing.
Directly, you might even say.
Yeah. This is an example of direct current.
Yeah.
Which means things. And then eventually we get to our boy, Michael Faraday.
Hey.
In 1821, mm-hmm. he found a series of apparatus that could cause things to spin because of electric current. And 10 years later, he found out that if you set things up right,
mm-hmm.
you can spin things and make electric current.
Hey, hey, hey.
The whole phenomenon he called electromagnetic induction. It's a reversible system. Either electricity can spin a wheel for you,
mm-hmm.
or you can spin a wheel and make electricity.
Yeah.
And the wheels kept on turning.
I see a theme going on. Right.
But if we back up to 1800, mm-hmm. as soon as Volta made his pile,
okay.
and we had a more or less continuous source of electricity,
mm.
people started trying to figure out how to use that to communicate over distance.
Oh, hey, okay.
Which involves some encoding and decoding of messages.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll talk about that
uh-huh.
next time. See you then.
Bye.